The next one is CEO of GE, Jeffrey Immelt. You may have seen him on TV lately trying to talk about his latest performance. This is a good time to turn off your cell phones, please. Now I'd like to introduce again, this is his second time here this year, and we're ever so grateful, the Reverend Ted Sauter to deliver the invocation. He's from the North Naples United Methodist Church.
It's a privilege. I was called yesterday because the other person who was going to pray was afraid of the general or something. I'm not sure what the reason was. And I'm honored to be asked. Methodist ministers are told that at the drop of a hat, you should be prepared to pray or eat with people, preach a sermon, or take up an offering. And I'm covering two today. And if the wait staff would leave the bread baskets out a little longer. Let's pray. It's not the prettiest day here, but it's a good day because we can be together in this wonderful spot, have good food, good fellowship, good ideas, good sharing. We're blessed to be a part of a great country, and although there have been challenges facing us individually and collectively throughout the country, we believe in its future and we respect its past. So we thank you for our speaker and his leadership, and all of those who prepared the meal and serve, and those who give leadership to this particular forum. We ask for your blessing. Amen.
And now, while you are starting to eat, I'd like to introduce Shelley Church, who chairs our student guest committee, to introduce our students today.
Good afternoon, everybody. Any Steelers fans out there? I would hope that there'd be a few in this crowd. We're delighted to have the Naples High students with us here today. I'm going to ask them to go ahead and start making their way up here while I make a couple opening remarks. I'd first like to acknowledge Linda Llewellyn, who is our sponsor today. Linda's a member of our club and is sponsoring the students, and one of them is her daughter, as a matter of fact. You'll get to hear from her. The other person I'd like to introduce is the gentleman who accompanied the students today, and you'll realize he's a very bright man because, of course, it's all young women that he brought with him, and that's Rob Garvey. Rob teaches U.S. History and Economics and AP classes, and he's sitting in the corner here at the student table. And when you hear from these girls, you'll certainly understand why he chose the young women that he brought today. Naples High School is 1,700 students. It's an A school, which is quite an honor. Very difficult to get an A school rating. They have a great football team that won the state championship in 2008. They also have a great softball team. They won the state championship in 2008. We have the number one and number two student at Naples High, and we have the leader of the ROTC from Naples High as well. So I know you'd rather hear from them rather than me, so I'm going to let them come up.
Good afternoon. I would like to start off by thanking the Forum Club for hosting my friends and me at this wonderful luncheon. My name is Stephanie Jones, and I'm the daughter of Susan and Paul Jones. I am an AP student at Naples High School, and I have three brothers who also attend Naples High. I'm the senior class president, vice president of the Performing Arts Club, and the captain of my swim and basketball teams. I'm also an active member of student government, National Honor Society, Mu Alpha Theta, Varsity Club, and Spanish Honor Society. I'm a member of the Naples High School Relay for Life team. When I have spare time, I enjoy scuba diving, reading, traveling, going to the beach, and making jewelry. I love to visit my family in Ohio and help out on my grandfather's farm. I am a laureate diploma candidate at Naples High, and my topic is the demise of coral reefs. In the fall, I may attend the University of Cincinnati and major in international business, and I want to study abroad. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the Forum Club for hosting myself and my fellow students this afternoon. My name is Sarah Lashley. I'm a senior at Naples High School. I am on the varsity swim team. I'm also a member of my school's Relay for Life team. I am an active member in National Honor Society, Spanish Honor Society, Key Club, and Envirothon. I am also an advanced placement laureate student, and the topic of my paper is the academic achievement gap in public schools. In my free time, I enjoy art, and I hope to go to the University of Florida next year to study journalism. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Simone Najon de l'Etat. My last name is French, just in case you're wanting to know. I am student government president this year, and I've also been the president of our class in sophomore and junior years. I'm very active in student government. I'm the team captain of our Relay for Life team. We're trying to raise $12,000 this year, so it's kind of a big undertaking. And I'm in Spanish Honor Society, National Honor Society, pretty much most of the clubs at Naples High. I am co-captain with Stephanie of the varsity swim team, and I am the principal chair cellist at the Naples Youth Philharmonic, or Philharmonic Youth Orchestra. So that's pretty cool. And also, when I graduate, I plan to either go to the University of Florida or possibly the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I would like to study education and comparative religion. Okay. Thank you.
I'm a little bit short. Kind of. Good afternoon. My name is Vanessa Barrero, and I'm a senior at Naples High School. I was born in Cali, Colombia, and I've been raised in the United States for 9 years now. I speak two languages. I'm fluently, and I'm trying really hard on my third one. In school, I'm in JROTC, and I'm one of the two highest ranked females, and I've had the opportunity to be involved in JROTC. 3 out of the 4 clubs that JROTC offers the students. I'm one of 3 females in the whole battalion, like, in charge, and I'm kind of like the boss that tells everyone what to do, and not a lot of people like that, but I like it. I'm the commander for the female raider team, and we are not going to states this year, but we made 3rd place in county, and outside of RTC, I'm involved in many, many clubs. Some of them are like Stuff Club, Book Club, Teen Corps at the courthouse. I volunteer at the sheriff's office, and I've been doing that for 2 years, and Teen Corps for 4. I was in charge of the Girl Scouts 2 years in a row, and I played varsity for wrestling, softball, and hockey. I have over 400 hours, community service hours, and some of my hobbies are reading, fencing, and oil painting. It's a little bit boring, but it's good. If I got accepted to the Citadel, that would be my top choice. I applied for 3 universities, the University of Toronto in Canada, and the Citadel in the United States, and the University of Santiago de Cali in Colombia. And I've been honored to be here. Thank you very much.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Marla Perez. I go to Naples High School also, and I'm valedictorian of my class. I'm an AP Laureate student. My topic is eliminating extreme poverty in third world countries, and it talks about the United Nations Millennial Goals. Also, I have been varsity lacrosse captain. of the Naples High School girls team for the past 2 years. I was part of the founding group of the lacrosse team there. I'm an active member of Mu Alpha Theta and National Honor Society, Spanish Honor Society. I was recently in an Envirothon competition and we won second place. We're proud of that. Also, I am applying to Columbia, Cornell. I heard that there were some Cornell alumni in here. And John Hopkins, because I wish to go into the medical field and become a surgeon. Thank you for having me.
Hi, my name is Nancy Flewelling, and I'm going to be the last student you're going to hear from today. I am ranked third in our Naples High senior class. I am an AP Scholar with Distinction and also a National Merit Commended Scholar. I won Best Witness in the state of Florida for the mock trial competition when I was in 10th grade. And I was also awarded Best Speaker at Princeton's Junior State of America program this summer. I'm in the Laureate program, and I am writing on the USA Patriot Act, continuing a paper that I started at Princeton while at camp this summer. And by the time I graduate high school, I will have had 14 AP classes, including both macro and microeconomics. I'm involved in both school and outside of school. In school, I'm president of the Performing Arts Club. I am vice president of the National Honor Society, and I help create fundraisers to raise money for our scholarship program, as well as the National Honor Society's contribution to Relay for Life. I'm active in Spanish Honor Society and on the Relay for Life team. I am a participant in Junior State of America, and I was vice president last year. It's a political debate club at our school, and also Mu Alpha Theta, which is our competitive math club. Outside of school, I am very active in music. I've been singing with the Naples Philharmonic for the past 6 years. I also teach music at the First Presbyterian Church, where I work as assistant director for the kids choir there. So I help them out on Wednesdays and Sundays. I am also in the adult chorale at the Naples Philharmonic. And at school, I've already told you about school, so you guys don't want to hear about that again, I'm sure. But continuing on about school, I have applied to Boston College, and I've been accepted to the honors program at the Carroll School of Management. And I hope to hear back from schools around April. I've also applied to Harvard, Princeton, University of Pennsylvania, Johns Hopkins, and Duke University. I think all of our students here today are very excited about being here, and also we do greatly honor the general that is going to be talking to us today. So I say thank you for all of us, and I hope you have a great lunch. Thank you.
Thank you.
One more little bit of business before we settle down, please. As always, these kids are not very impressive. And in case you might want to meet some of these, not necessarily these youngsters, but young men and women that come in here, but also some other great students around the county, Roy White, who is the chairman of our education committee, has an invitation for you.
Good afternoon. In deference to Ted Souter, my pastor, I'm not going to pass the basket today. I'm going to let him do that Sunday. But however, you will notice there's a yellow form on each table, and if you'd care to take that home with you and fill it out and perhaps make a pledge or write a check, we'd appreciate it, and so would the children. We're in the process now of forming our interview teams. And these teams will visit the various schools and interview the student applicants for our scholarships. And if any of you, and we hope that some of you will want to participate in that process, I'd appreciate it, and we will appreciate it if you would advise the Forum Club office or me, and we'd be happy to try to include you in that process. You'll find it perhaps one of the most rewarding experiences of your life. Our applicant awardees are based on achievement and need, and a mixture of the two, not necessarily exclusive. You will not believe some of the adverse circumstances that these kids conquer. I'd like to make note of one. The first application that we reviewed last year, the young lady said, "I'm a homeless student," and yet she had an average that was superlative. She was active in every form of extracurricular activities. She was the president of several organizations, and of course she did get a scholarship. But so I urge you to try to participate in some way, and I thank you for your attention.
Enjoy your lunch. We'll be back in a few minutes. Bringing our speaker to us today. And we don't pay honoraria to our speakers, but our host for the speaker today worked for the Hershey Company in Pennsylvania. And I understand there's a huge chocolate bar maybe wending its way to our speaker's home before too long. Please thank Joe Viviano for bringing our speaker today. He will introduce our speaker.
Good afternoon and welcome, everyone. It's a genuine pleasure for me to introduce today's speaker. General John Abizaid retired from the U.S. Army after serving 34 years of active service. After graduating from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, the general rose from an infantry platoon leader to become the youngest four-star general in the Army. At the time of his retirement, he was the longest-serving commander of the U.S. Central Command. As a combatant commander of the U.S. Command, he was responsible for the military strategy and joint operations in the Middle East, the Horn of Africa, and Central Asia. Serving 54 months in combat zones, both as a deputy commander and combatant commander, he led simultaneous international coalitions that operated in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, and the Persian Gulf. He was one of the first to recognize the protracted nature of this conflict against religious-inspired extremists, and in response, he reorganized the theater to fight what he termed the Long War, a regional struggle unmatched for its complexity and its durability. The general has worked on the joint staff three times, the last as director, and during his tenure as director, he advised the chairman and secretary of the defense on the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, Homeland Security, and all military operations worldwide. He studied at the University of Jordan in Amman, holds a master's degree in Middle East Studies from Harvard, and considered by many to be an expert in the field of Middle Eastern affairs. General Abizaid is a highly decorated officer who has been awarded the Defense Service Medal, the Army's Distinguished Service Medal, the Legion of Merit, and the Bronze Star. He holds military honors from numerous countries, Germany, France, Poland, Australia, Afghanistan, and Egypt. He's a member of the Council of Foreign Affairs and International Institute for Strategic Studies. He currently serves as the director of the George Olmsted Foundation, USAA, and RPM International, a New York Stock Exchange company, and we serve on that board together. He and his wife, Kathy, are residents of Garnerville, Nevada. The general will not only discuss the specific and real dangers and opportunities in places like Iraq and Pakistan, but hopefully make us all get some sense out of the entire strategic landscape and address some of the challenges especially with this new administration. Please join me in a warm Naples welcome to an outstanding American, General John Abizaid.
Well, thank you, Joe. Thank you, everybody. It's great to be here in Naples. Kathy and I are honored to be here in Florida while it's snowing in Gardnerville, Nevada. So we think this is a very good day. I'd like to recognize the students one more time. Where are you? Stand up. Stand up. Look at the crowd. Now, crowd. So the crowd has looked at you. They've heard what you had to say. And at the end of the day, I knew this from my time as Commandant of Cadets at West Point also, that whenever you start to feel bad about the direction of the country, just meet young people like this. We may have screwed it up, but they will get it straight. So thank you. Thanks. I wondered what would I have said in their position if, you know, a young high school student coming up before a group like this. Hello, my name is John Abizaid. I avoided being arrested last night for underage drinking. weren't very many superlatives that I could have thrown in. I'd like to introduce my wife, Kathy Abizaid. Kathy and I have been around each other for a long time. We went to school out in the Great West, which is high school, where we decided to get together, and now we have three kids. Our son-in-law just went back to Iraq for his, I can't tell you how many times, I can only tell you that my son-in-law, who's a major in the United States Army, wounded once in combat in Iraq, served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, has 10 more months of combat duty under his belt than my dad did, and my dad left for the Navy in 1942 in February, came back in August of 1945. And the reason I'm saying this about my son-in-law is not to point out to you a special circumstance, but to make you understand that there's a very small group of young Americans that defend us, that fight for us, and that do a terrific job for us that are often unthought of and unloved in many ways. But I would like you to remember the young men and women that are fighting for us abroad and the veterans that are coming home, and if we could just give them a round of applause. All my kids said they'd never have anything to do with service to the nation, and at one point, my son-in-law was in Afghanistan, I was in Qatar, my daughter was in Beirut, my son was in Korea, and Kathy was going crazy. And we were all serving the nation, and so my point is that these young people, when you hear their resumes and you talk to them, they want to serve. They want to be part of the solution to whatever problems we face. And we should encourage them in every way, help them in every way, and trust them to do the right thing. I certainly do. And when I watch our young soldiers, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardmen, Navy people out there fighting, I know that everything is going to be fine. But it won't be easy. Now, I'd like to do something, if you'd allow me to. If you're a veteran of the United States Army, could you stand up? I'd like to recognize all the Army people. Could we give them a hand, please? Thank you. Thank you. That's a good amount of Army people here. All right, no catcalls from the Army people. Marines. Former Marines. Always a Marine. Thank you, Marines. Thank you very much. Air Force, United States Air Force. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thanks. Always like to remind the Air Force people it used to be the Army Air Corps. Coast Guard people, where are you? All right, thank you, sir. Thanks very much. And, of course, there used to be a service known as the United States Navy. But after beating Army 7 times in a year, we abolished it. God bless the Navy. My dad was the chief motor machinist mate in the Navy in World War II. And when it came time to try to figure out where I was going to go to school, I said, should I be a career Army guy, a career Navy guy? He said, be an Army guy. Because he wanted me to suffer. But anyway, thank any State Department people, CIA people? Never mind. Okay, all right. But the truth of the matter is the amount of service in this room, whether you were a member of the armed forces, whether you served your community, whether you happened to serve on a board of directors somewhere that made a company better and added to the prosperity of the nation, is something that I think this room is filled with. And I want to thank each and every one of you for your contribution to our nation. And now we've got to talk about how we're going to get out of this particular problem that we're facing. And the problem that I'm going to talk about is not going to be the problem of the economy, because I don't know anything about it, other than to say, as I look at it, I'm worried about it, and I should be. The problem we have, dual problems, is how we deal with an international environment that is very dangerous and a national environment that is also economically dangerous, and work our way with the new administration through difficult times. And I think this is something that we're all going to have to think about, talk about, and get together to move in a positive consensus towards a solution that's good for the nation. Now, the area that I commanded, I know a lot of you don't know what CENTCOM is. The area I commanded had 27 nations in it. It went from Kazakhstan. People know where Kazakhstan is because of the great movie Borat. I understand that. But then down through Afghanistan, Pakistan, across Iran, over into the Levant, Mesopotamia, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, etc., Egypt, down through Sudan, the Horn of Africa, that included Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, a very, very interesting area. As you know, most of the time when I was the commander in the region, I was not the tactical or the operational commander. I was the long-term strategic commander for the area, and Secretary Rumsfeld was my boss. And I used to be 6 foot six. but I'm going to tell you a quick story about Secretary Rumsfeld, and I also want to say up front that I have great respect for the man, a patriot who served the country well and faithfully. So he calls me up one day in 2003, and I had 25 countries. Syria and Lebanon were not part of my area. And he calls me up and he says, General Abizaid, I have been looking at the map and I noticed that Syria and Lebanon are not in your area of operation. And it's my opinion that you should consider them coming into your area. What is your opinion? So I said, well, Mr. Secretary, all things being equal, got a war in Iraq, a war in Afghanistan, piracy off the coast of Somalia, terrorism in every one of these countries, 300,000 Americans fighting over here, 200,000 Allied troops fighting. I've got my hands full, and I don't want them. So, frank exchange of views. And he said, after thinking about it for 5 seconds, thank you, you've got them. And I said, well, thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. While you're at it, could you give me Haiti and North Korea? And he did not, fortunately. But this area of the Middle East is an area in great turmoil, and we do need to think about the fact that we have a lot of our sons and daughters fighting in the Middle East, and we do need to recognize the fact that there will be a need longer for them to continue to fight in the Middle East, and too many people want to look at the problems of this broader area in great turmoil through a soda straw of interest that goes directly to Iraq or directly to Afghanistan. We have to understand that the problems in the region are connected, they're difficult, they're pervasive, and if American leadership, power, and prestige do not help to shape the region, it could move into one of the most difficult international problems for the nation in the 21st century. Now, the new government has moved in a very interesting way right up front. Usually, governments have waited till about the eighth year of their time in office, if they served 8 years, to try to solve a Middle Eastern problem. And it's never long enough. It never really allows you to get moving. But I think it should be noted that immediately upon taking office, President Obama did some interesting things. He reached out to Middle Eastern leaders, talked to them all personally, I think within the first day when he was in office. He sent George Mitchell to deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace, which is a very difficult thing to do, if not one of the most difficult things any human being will have to try to sort out. He moved Ambassador Holbrooke to deal with the broader problems associated with Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, South Asia, which of course is becoming acute and very, very difficult for the nation to deal with. And then he got on El Arabiya, the Arab network that's based in Dubai, and he gave a very interesting interview directed to the Muslims in the Middle East to essentially say, we ought to be able to bridge this gap of lack of understanding that exists between our culture and your culture. We ought to be able to move towards a better future in our approach to how we deal with these sorts of problems. And at the same time, we continue to fight in Iraq. We continue to start fight in Afghanistan, difficulties in Pakistan. We can go on and on about the difficulties in the region, but I would tell you that I've come to see the problems in the Middle East as being emblematic of the first battle of globalization, the first battle of a globalized planet trying to come to grips with modernizing societies, religions, great difficulties that are transnational, and it is a tough battle indeed that is being fought out there. Now, in my way of thinking, I've come to look at the challenges for the nation in the region as essentially being four. We could say 400. I'm going to talk to you about what I think the four big challenges are, give you some sort of idea of how I think they need to be approached, and then, of course, we'll go into a period where we have time for questions and answers. I can assure you I always look forward to the question and answer session. I should warn you ahead of time that I have testified before the Senate, and I know how to avoid your question better than you. Better than you can imagine. But the four big problems that we need to concentrate on and we need to think about have to do with dynamics that are going on in the region that are not the fault of the United States. It's always interesting to me, as many years as I've been in the Middle East. Matter of fact, I spent half my military career fighting in the Middle East. Two wars in Iraq, wars in Afghanistan, many other difficult circumstances in the Middle East as a younger officer. First time we went over there was in 1978. One of my daughters was born over there. Essentially fought half my life in the half my professional life in the Middle East. My son, my daughters, my son-in-law have fought or served in the military while the military's been fighting in the Middle East for half of their professional careers. And I am determined that we must find a way through talking, through diplomacy, through military action, through whatever we need to do so that my grandkids don't need to fight half their lives in the Middle East. So what are the dynamics that are going on over there? What is happening? What makes this so difficult? And I say the first thing we need to pay attention to is the rise of Sunni extremist Islamic activity by people such as bin Laden and organizations such as Al-Qaeda. This is not a bunch of crazy terrorists hiding up in the hills of Afghanistan and Pakistan. They are people that have a view of the world that is hostile to the United States, hostile to the vast majority of governments in the region, and desires to become the primary focus of the future ideologically in that part of the world. It is an ideology that you can see how it functions by thinking how the Taliban ran Afghanistan. Go to the soccer stadium to see executions. No music. Women have no part in your society. Laws are so stringent that there's generally little recourse between life and death and the judgment of judges. Education is not valued. This is the type of future that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda provided for the people of Afghanistan. and it's the type of future they were hoping to establish in Iraq, that they're hoping to establish in Saudi Arabia and other places. This idea, while it is repugnant to us, and while its ideology is very, very religious in its outlook and very elitist in its outlook, is still very dangerous to us. And the good news is the vast majority of people in the region don't want this ideology to become mainstream. They don't want to live under the extremist banner, yet the extremists are well organized. Imagine a non-state actor that has an ideology in place that desires to dominate the world, that is able to link people through the internet, can figure out how to attack the United States of America, Great Britain, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and I could go on and on and on and name names of places where they've managed to have global reach. This is not a group of people to be dismissed lightly. They're at the beginning of their ideological ascendancy. They need to be stopped primarily by the good people in the region. But we need to understand that if this ideology becomes ascendant in the region, it will represent one of the worst dangers for the United States, and it's important that we come up with reasonable ways to approach the rise of this ideological movement. It is not unlike, in my estimation, where fascism was in the early 1920s or where Bolshevism was in the early 1900s. It's a movement that's trying to attract people and recruits. It has gained ascendancy in some areas, and in other areas it's been put down. Yet it always seems to be able to come back because it's resilient, because of the dissatisfaction of people with governments, with their lives, with the prospects for their future, and dissatisfied that their religion in particular is being debased by aggressive cultural influences from nations such as ourselves. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying this movement needs to be one that we pay attention to. It needs to be one that we figure out how to confront. Second big issue in the region is another ideological movement. It's the rise of Shia Islamic ideology as exemplified by the nation-state of Iran. Again, it's intensely religious, a mullah government. It's funny, we Americans don't ever want to talk about religion. Yet when you're in the Middle East, these groups only talk about religion. Everything that they want to do is based upon a religious context of how they see the world, even though they have cloaked themselves in the legitimacy of Islam. They really don't represent it, but they're hijacking the religion to motivate people to move towards violent and difficult conclusions. And what about the Iranians? The Iranians have managed to sponsor terrorist groups in southern Lebanon. They've managed to figure out how to help Hamas in the Palestinian movement, how to cause problems down in eastern Saudi Arabia, how to do things in western Afghanistan, southern Iraq. The Iranians' desire to be the dominant Islamic power in the Persian Gulf region, in the Arabian Gulf region, as my Arabian friends would say. They desire to dominate the region. They believe in many respects that Israel has no right to exist. They are an expansionistic power that wants to figure out a way to get its arms around a nuclear weapon and to expand their influence into a region. And in order to do this, it would require them to remove or to push back on American power. Like Sunni extremism, Shia extremism can't coexist with an American power in the region. It needs American power to be withdrawn in order for it to become ascendant. Unlike Sunni extremism, Shia extremism is attached to a nation state. And there are very, very many complex natures about Iran that we need to pay attention to. Often people want to rush to war with Iran immediately because we think somehow or other that they can dominate the region easily or quickly. The truth of the matter is Iran is still a weak state. It doesn't have great natural resources that are easily exploitable, but it does have the capability to put a lot of people in the field, to bring resources together to produce a nuclear weapon, and to threaten the region with a certain amount of military power and capability. The interesting thing about Iran, though, is that the vast majority of people in Iran don't support this mullah government. They're looking for a change. How do we facilitate that change? How do we move forward in the 21st century? How do we prevent them from establishing a nuclear weapons regime in the Middle East that allows for greater proliferation? These are the challenges that the new administration will face. The third great issue in the region is one that we see all the time unfolding before our eyes on our national television screens, and it's the continued corrosive effect of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And if it continues to go on, a small war sooner or later will become a big war. And in a nuclearizing Middle East, a small war could become a nuclear war. Already we have Israel with nuclear weapons, Pakistan with nuclear weapons, Iran wanting to develop a nuclear weapon. And if Iran develops a nuclear weapon, we could assume that Egypt or Saudi Arabia would develop a nuclear weapon. Why on earth would we want nuclear weapons to be endemic to this part of the world with all of the chances for instability and difficulties that exist there? The Palestinian-Israeli problem drives people to the extremes. It increases the ranks of the people that are trying to fill the ranks of Al-Qaeda and trying to fill the ranks of the Shia extremist groups. It creates a problem that is almost insoluble were it not for the fact that American leadership might just be able to move them to a good future. The question for us is, how do we preserve the independence and integrity of a free and democratic Israel, and at the same time come up with some sort of a solution that protects the dignity, the honor, and the security of the Palestinians? Can it be done? Well, so far it hasn't been. Must it be done? Absolutely. The fourth thing, something that everybody understands very well, especially in a place such as Naples where you like to drive around and go on out into the Everglades, it's oil. Our dependence on Middle Eastern oil in particular creates a dynamic for us where we don't have a lot of geopolitical maneuver space. It creates a dynamic where American soldiers must continually be moved into the Middle East to deal with security problems there in order to protect this precious commodity. The globalizing planet requires the flow of oil. Before us, it was the British that controlled the sea lanes and protected the flow of oil. Today, it's the United States Armed Forces. But this requirement to protect this flow of oil that we are so dependent on can be lessened if we can figure out how to reduce our dependency on Middle Eastern oil, how to find alternatives, how to conserve more, how to cause the genius of the United States of America to move towards better technological conclusions to this dependency that currently exists. So these four strategic problems that are now squarely in the lap of the Obama administration, the rise of Sunni extremism, the rise of Shia extremism, the Arab-Israeli conflict, and our continued dependency on Middle Eastern oil are the strategic drivers of the future of the United States of America, and they all must have some sort of a vision for solution. And I would tell you that, unfortunately, there's no five-second soundbite anywhere that's going to solve them. First and foremost, we have to confront bin Laden and his people. We have to understand that they're intent on attacking us. To me, it's a miracle that we've only been attacked once in a major way here. It's inevitable that we will be attacked again. Yet, they cannot ever defeat us. We can, and in my opinion again, we can and we have been over and amongst them, causing them to disrupt their command and control, their organizational skills, and by deploying forces into their areas, we have made it much more difficult for them to be able to conduct attacks and grow to the size and the danger that they're capable of growing to. We must contain Iranian power. Notice I didn't say destroy it. I'm betting on the good Iranian people in the long run to figure out how to move beyond this crazy mullah government that they have. They're educated people, they're capable people, they know that they want to change. Give them the opportunity to make this change, and we can move into the 21st century in much safer and understandable opportunities. The Arab-Israeli war, we must move forward quickly, seize the opportunity not only for American diplomacy to work, but also the opportunity for international diplomacy to work there. And I've told you what I think about oil. So I would tell you, because it's time now to start going to questions, I would tell you that I think we have done a good job in dealing with our problems in Iraq and Afghanistan. I know that may be contrary to what a lot of people say, but our armed forces have fought well, but they need help. They need help from diplomats. They need help in the economic arena. They need help from private enterprise, people that are willing to risk some of their capital in these places to allow them to develop more. They need help in education. They need help in information. They need help in intelligence. We have done a good job in gaining time for our nation to deal with these problems. Now the Obama administration will need help from all of us in bringing the great power of diplomacy, education, information, intelligence, military power, economic power to bear on the problems of the Middle East. Ultimately, it will not be the United States that controls this region. The Romans couldn't control it. The British couldn't control it. We can't control it. But we can shape the outcome so that our ideals and our desire for a better world for our children become paramount and superior to those that people embrace that have to do with bin Laden and his ideas. I think it is inevitable that the good people of the region will take this fight increasingly to themselves and lead it themselves, but we have to go from us being in the lead militarily to them being in the lead militarily, to give them help with all the other elements of national power and figure out how to do this at a time of great economic crisis. I've seen our troops in the field. I know what they can do. They've been out there fighting now for 8 years, never lost a single battle in combat, not even at the platoon level. No war in the history of the United States has ever been fought with more competent people, but they need help. How are we going to get that help to the people in the field? That's the challenge of the new administration. That's the challenge of all of us. I believe in those young people fighting out there, and I believe that we can bring a successful conclusion to these problems, not in the short run, but in the long run. Patience, perseverance, courage, American traditions that have always come to bear on great problems are going to be the same sorts of ideals and requirements that will come to bear to serve this. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm ready for your questions. Thank you very much.
General, before Joe comes up to, you can see he has quite a stack of questions, so I'm not going to take very long. We have two books to present to you. And one of them is about Naples and the other about Marco Island. We're hoping that you're going to come back and visit us when you don't have to be on duty and enjoy this this area. We really appreciate your being here. Everybody, what do you think?
Thanks very much, Alan.
Thank you.
Okay, Joe.
Well, we have hundreds of questions, and unless we want to be here for the rest of the afternoon, I'm going to have to consolidate some of these. So if some questions weren't asked, please understand. The first one is a multiple choice. What are we really trying to accomplish in Afghanistan and instead of expanding our troops, should we bite the bullet and get out in Afghanistan? Do we really have an effective strategic exit from Afghanistan? And would an Iraqi-type surge be effective there?
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator, for that question. Unfortunately, the Secretary of Defense couldn't be here today to answer it. It's a great question. What are we doing in Afghanistan? And who else has been there? Well, just about everybody. And it's been a tough go for everybody. I noticed the other day that Secretary Gates said, we've got to adopt realistic conditions for what we're trying to achieve in Afghanistan. And I'd say he's absolutely right. The question, of course, is what's realistic? What are we trying to achieve there? Too often people thought that in both Iraq and Afghanistan that we're going to try to build some sort of Swiss-like, democratic, European state. It won't happen in the Muslim culture, not in my estimation. Maybe people will agree with me. But there can be more accountable governments, more capable governments, more prosperous governments, and governments that will, most importantly for us, not allow these safe havens of terrorists to establish themselves on their soil. After all, the attack on the World Trade Center was planned in Afghanistan. And it was planned there, or was pretty well executed by people that were in these network groups that were sent about and came together in our own country. But I think in Afghanistan, we have to understand one thing, most importantly. The key to success in Afghanistan is actually not within the borders of Afghanistan. It's in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border area. And it is in this border area known as the federally administered tribal area and the northwest frontier area and other areas that are within the nation state of Pakistan, where the Taliban, after being pushed out of Afghanistan, and Al-Qaeda, after being pushed out of Afghanistan, reorganized, retrained, re-equipped, and has been able to operate in a way that's been very serious to what's going on, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan. As a commander in the region, as much as I worried about in Iraq and Afghanistan, my real worries were the future of Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Pakistan, the largest Muslim nation on earth after Indonesia, and it's nuclear armed. And if there is a period of instability there, it is not inconceivable that nuclear weapons could fall into the hands of these people that hate us so much, our friends in Al-Qaeda. They have said on numerous occasions that they want to use a nuclear weapon or a weapon of mass destruction. We overran anthrax labs in Afghanistan. They've been working on this stuff over and over. And so far, you know, things have gone our way. They haven't got these things. But while the weapons of mass destruction argument was ridiculed as a result of not finding any inside Iraq, the truth of the matter is that this problem in the Middle East is hugely important to us precisely because of the possibility that weapons of mass destruction might go loose and our enemies are so ruthless and so desperate that they would feel a need to use it against us. So Afghanistan, we need not just more troops. The solution to these problems in the region, everyone in the press wants to drive it towards more troops. More troops buy you time. Unless we're fighting a World War II campaign where the country has sent us over there to conquer as opposed to stabilize, troops will buy time. But economic, diplomatic, political, and educational action have to take place there. The Pakistan border area is out of control, partially because the Pakistani government abandoned education of its own people 40 years ago. So who came in? Extremist Saudi Wahhabi teachers. It's no wonder that the population is Islamicized in the extreme. So I think we have to say it's going to take a long time in Afghanistan. NATO, Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, the international community must work together not to rebuild Afghanistan, because it is not a rebuilding issue. It's a building issue. Afghanistan is not a modern nation that was brought down. It's a nation that's pre-modern that needs to be built up. And I'm confident that over the next decade, it can become more stable, but not necessarily with more American forces. We need to build more Afghan forces. Thanks.
This is not a question. I think this just concludes what we just heard, and I think it's a thought many of us have this morning. Given how many different countries have failed in Afghanistan, why do we think we can be successful? And I think you just answered that. After a U.S. military drawdown, will democracy last, and will the fighting sectarian fighting ever be reduced?
Say that one again.
Military drawdown, will democracy last in this country, and will sectarian fighting ever be stopped or reduced?
And we're talking about Iraq.
Yes, we're talking about Iraq.
Yeah.
I assume, yes.
I'm sure we're talking about Iraq. Well, by the way, Kathy and I live in Gardnerville, Nevada. Anybody know where that is? Glad? Well, it's near the California-Nevada border area, mountainous area, and we decided to retire there because it's a lot like the Afghanistan-Pakistan border area. Everybody's heavily armed, and they hate the federal government. And because I'm a military guy, I'm building militias up there. But the issues about Iraq and Afghanistan, first of all, we must be realistic about what we expect. Will Iraq or Afghanistan emerge in the image of the United States? No. But will Iraq and Afghanistan, could they be more accountable, more productive, more peaceful, and less of a haven for terrorism? And I think the answer is yes. In Afghanistan in particular, it's hard right now. It's the situation while we decided to move more forces into Iraq, it created a problem for us to be able to deal effectively with the situation in Afghanistan. Now we're having to address that. This Saturday in Iraq, Iraqis are going to vote for a new provincial government. New provincial government's far from perfect. It's very sectarian. Sunnis will vote for Sunni parties. Shia will vote for Shia parties. Kurds will vote for Kurd parties. Lines will harden between the ethnic groups. But on the other hand, people are voting. They're participating. Security is being handled by the Iraqis, and it's clear that we're going to be able to withdraw more of our troops here in the months ahead. Will it work in the long run? I don't know. But I think now that we have embarked upon it, we have to do everything in our power to give it a chance to work. And I think Iraq is a completely different place from when I first went there to fight in 1991.
In your opinion, will we face another terrorist attack in our country, let's say, over the next 1 or 2 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Does anybody here think we won't? If you knew the guys that I've been dealing with on the opposite side of the ledger, I always used to find it interesting as an American officer, we'd be over there fighting. I spent most of my time over there. And somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean, when I'd be called back to testify, I'd pass through this membrane. You know, confidence on this side, hopelessness on this side. And that's as you got closer to Washington, you know? And I'd land and I'd talk to people in the press and in Congress, and they'd sit there and say, oh my God, we're losing. I said, no, but it's hard, it's long, it's difficult. But, you know, don't think of it as losing. Think of it as embarking upon a journey that we have to finish. And so we were always confident, and people over here are always impatient, and I understand that. And I'm very impatient. My kids have risked their lives over there, and I'm anxious for that to go down. But when I think about what can happen if we walk away, if we just walk away from that part of the world, if we don't pay attention to Israel, if we don't pay attention to Palestine, if we let the Iraqis go whatever direction they want, if we're unable to help the Afghans, if we can't tamp down bin Laden and his gang of merry men, if Iran becomes a nuclear problem, what hope is there for a better future for the United States? So sometimes I think we just have to do what we have to do. We have to do it better. I'll be the first to say we've made many mistakes, but to think that we could walk away, no.
With Obama's new presidency, and this is a blue ticket, one of the students.
Blue ticket from the students. Which one?
And this is a tough one. With Obama's new president, what do you believe will happen in the U.S. involvement in the Middle East? And there's another question similar to that. Do you see any changes in policy in the Middle East?
Great question. Do I see changes in policy? Well, I see them already. He's already moving forward with very senior people diplomatically. So if our foot forward was military in the last administration, and I'm not saying that was wrong. I'm not one of these soldiers that will criticize my former leaders. But if we think that being forward militarily was our policy before, it's clear to me that the new president wants to move forward diplomatically. And he would undoubtedly like to move forward with less military action. But there's the unspoken story of the war, which is the enemy. And I would tell you, as a soldier, the enemy always has a vote. This enemy is deadly, it's dangerous, it's committed, it has a way of thinking about the world that we need to pay attention to. They figured out how to knock the Spanish out of Iraq back in 2004 by attacking in Madrid. and this enemy remains to be heard from. They can make breakthroughs too. They will make our lives difficult. And so, yes, I think there will be an attack on the United States at some point. It's inevitable that there's a breakthrough there. But I also think that the new president will continue the attack against terrorism, continue military activity in the region at a lesser level, and he will do what he can to shift the balance from us being in the lead to the good people in the region being in the lead. And all those things I talked about are difficult things to do. He will not fix these big problems in the Middle East probably much quicker than he fixes the economy. But he is moving forward in a way that I think is coherent and one of deserving, in my mind, of respect.
This is another blue card, more on the human element of battle. How do you personally cope with the emotional, painful scenes you witness in such third world countries?
Well, that was usually when my family was with me in the third world country. And I had the emotional scene of my wife and kids driving me crazy over there.
I had the same problem with my son-in-law,
yeah,
too.
War is an awful thing. And to the students, if you think soldiers want war or like war, you don't really know a soldier. We're the last people who want to go to war because we know what it's like. But we're the first people to say that there are some things worth fighting for. And this country is worth fighting for. So as bad as it is, I've never fought in a fight where I didn't think it was worth what we were doing.
Another blue card. As a four-star general, do you feel free to express your political opinions?
No, I think you all know that from my talk today. Look, I'm not a political guy. I'm not running for governor in Nevada. I'm not trying to be the senator from this great state of Florida. I'm a soldier that is deeply concerned that we move forward in the security arena in a way that protects our interests. Because one of the things I didn't say is that in addition to this problem in the Middle East, we're also entering into a period where our peer competitors have increased in power and stature. And it's China, it's Russia, it's India, it's others. Doesn't mean it needs to be confrontational, doesn't mean it needs to be dangerous, but we would be foolish to look at the history of the world and think that a great nation such as ours will not be in a competitive environment. And this competitive requirement requires that the insurance policy known as the Armed Forces of the United States of America stays sharp and ready. And if I were to warn you about what I think is one of the most difficult problems we face in the armed forces, it's particularly the Army and the Marine Corps staying sharp and ready. If you're in the Army and the Marine Corps today, you are either in Iraq or Afghanistan, coming back and recovering from Iraq and Afghanistan, or getting ready to go to Iraq and Afghanistan. There's no ability to, you know, make it bigger despite what the pundits may say. So if this is going to be a long war, we're going to have to figure out how to bring our young people home in the right way at the right time, rest them, retrain them, re-equip them, and at the same time not take our eye off of growing Chinese and Russian problems.
This is a little change of pace here. From my knowledge of military, much time and effort is spent on developing and especially training of leadership in the military. Can you contrast the military style and focus on leadership development versus a typical U.S. corporation?
Well, the only typical U.S. corporation that I could really speak about today would be Hershey Chocolates. Well,
let's not answer the question.
No, look. I'm really not qualified to talk about the corporate world. I've only recently begun to have an opportunity to see how things are there, things work there. But interesting dynamics. In the corporate world, the companies I'm in spend an awful lot of time talking about succession plans without ever having one. I mean, you know, and in the military, we all know in every action exactly what the chain of command is. At the end of every order we issue, we say the chain of command is battalion commander, company commander, and you know who's going to be the person to be in charge if somebody gets killed, because that's the nature of our business. The other thing is that in an officer's career in the United States Army, we train them and educate them in literally 50% of their careers. 50% of their careers are either in a military school or a civilian school learning their profession. It's not a profession of a bunch of amateurs. It's people that are trained to learn to do what is a difficult job. And more training, more leader development in the civilian world, I think, would go a long ways, especially in the financial sector.
What part of the equation does Russia play? Have you been able to read Putin's eyes?
Well, I did meet Putin. I met him with Secretary Rumsfeld. And this was back in the days when I was on the joint staff. And we went to Russia and we were negotiating a drawdown of nuclear weapons with the Russians. And I didn't read his eyes, but it was clear to me that he was an ex-KGB guy. And it was clear to me that he was a tough guy. And it was clear to me that whatever bad things you may think about him, he's trying to bring his country forward into the 21st century. He loves his country, he loves his people, and he believes that there is a rightful place for Russia in the 21st century. The question for all of us, will it be confrontational again or not? And it's important that our diplomats and our president and our, at the same time keeping our military guard up, that we look for ways to bring Russia into the system of nations.
I think I just got the word. I want to apologize. We have many more questions that weren't answered. It just shows the obvious interest in this.
Can I say one thing, Joe?
Absolutely.
That I didn't say? I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep you, and I see the hook here. look, ladies and gentlemen, one thing I'd like to say is our veterans are coming back, and many of them are looking for places to work. They're looking for help in environments that they're not used to. I'd ask you to find a veteran, help a veteran, and if you know somebody who's employing them, get a veteran a job.
Thank you. What a great speech. Please remember, leave your name tags at the door, and don't forget your umbrellas.
Oh, good. Oh, thank you, Tom. Thank you very much. Thanks. Well, you know.